50715, Students for Fair Admissions versus University of Texas. And we'll hear first from Mr. Connolly.
Good morning.
Hello.
May it please the court, Michael Connolly for the appellant, Students for Fair Admissions. In the summer of 2020, SFFA sued the University of Texas, alleging that UT's use of race in its admissions process violates the Equal Protection Clause. SFFA sued on behalf of its members, including two students who were recently rejected from UT. SFFA has filed similar cases against other universities. Its cases against Harvard and the University of North Carolina are currently pending before the Supreme Court of the United States. But unlike the lower courts in those cases, the district court below refused to reach the merits of SFFA's claims against UT. The district court held that SFFA's claims were barred under res judicata because of Fisher versus the University of Texas. In Fisher, an 18-year-old high school senior named Abigail Fisher sued UT when she was denied admission in 2008.
You know what? I think we're pretty familiar with Fisher.
Right. And that was more than 14 years ago. And so the district court found res judicata appropriate, however, because Ms. Fisher joined SFFA's five-person board of directors after she graduated, and another SFFA director, Edward Bloom, assisted Ms. Fisher in her previous litigation against UT. The opinion below plainly violates Supreme Court and Fifth Circuit precedent. Non-party claim preclusion is allowed only in rare and specific circumstances, none of which exist here. This court should reverse, and this case should be decided on the merits. So I'd like to start with claim preclusion and the first element of this, which is the privity aspect. UT has no answer for Taylor versus Sturgill. This is the Supreme Court case, a unanimous Supreme Court case, in which the Supreme Court held that non-party claim preclusion is appropriate in only six circumstances. That's it. And the Supreme Court said that's because the fundamental rule is that every individual, every party deserves their day in court. And so it outlined exactly six circumstances. And there's no dispute that neither from the district court nor from UT, that UT cannot meet any of these circumstances. So that should end the first element right here. And it's not just Taylor, but there is a long decades worth of precedent from the Fifth Circuit with similar holdings that non-party claim preclusion is allowed only in very specific circumstances. Again, none of which apply here. And finally, the Third, the Fourth, and the 11th Circuits have all held that if you cannot satisfy one of the Taylor circumstances, then you are not entitled to non-party claim preclusion. Now, what the district court did instead is the district court pointed to one of the exceptions from Taylor. This is the control exception. And the district court said, well, it's close enough to that. Because here, according to the district court, Mr. Bloom and Ms. Fisher, quote, exerted control over both lawsuits. But that, again, is not the test under Taylor or under this court's precedents. And in fact, it clearly runs afoul of Taylor. Now, in Taylor, the defendant in Taylor asked the Supreme Court, it said, the way you should look at non-party claim preclusion is you should have a fact-bound inquiry, and you should have an equitable inquiry, and you should weigh all the facts, and you should try to figure out whether this is close enough. And the Supreme Court rejected that. It said, non-party claim preclusion requires crisp rules and sharp corners. And that's because of how important the fundamental rule is that every party and every individual should have their day in court. And so what UT did, or what the district court did below, is exactly what what the Supreme Court said not to do, which is to weigh all the facts and just to kind of come to a feeling of whether this is close enough to one of the exceptions. So the first exception, they can't meet it. The first element of privity, they can't meet it. Now you have the fourth element of claim preclusion, whether this is the same claim or cause of action. Now, again, this court's precedents say when you are looking to see whether you have the same claim or cause of action between two lawsuits, what you should look at are the restatement factors. This is time, space, origin, motivation, and whether it forms a convenient trial unit. District court didn't address any of these factors. On appeal, UT ignores all of these factors. And the reason it ignores all of these factors is that none of them apply. So going down the list here, time, space. SFFA filed its case in the summer of 2020. Ms. Fisher filed her case in 2008, more than 12 years before SFFA filed its case. And not only is that important because that's an enormous amount of time, but the Supreme Court in Fisher 2 was very clear about what it was looking at. In the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court said, we are only looking at 2008. We're only looking at when Ms. Fisher was denied from UT in 2008. That's it. So you have an enormous gap in time. Origin and motivation. SFFA is suing on behalf of its members. It wants its members to be able to apply to UT in a system where they are not being discriminated against. If SFFA prevails, this will not have an immediate effect for Ms. Fisher. Ms. Fisher is in her 30s. She's already graduated. So again, origin and motivation, it doesn't work. And finally, the convenient trial unit, this one is really on point. Here, if this case is remanded and this case goes to trial, the case is going to be about whether UT's current use of race satisfies strict scrutiny. Again, Ms. Fisher's case was all about 2008. And the Supreme Court, in cases like Lucky Brands and Whole Women's Health, has said that when facts occur after the first case, that almost always says that there's no non-party claim preclusion here. And we have that exactly here. So look at some of the facts that are in the complaint that have happened since Ms. Fisher filed her complaint in 2008. First, racial balancing. In our complaint, we allege that in 9 out of the past 10 years, UT's admissions for African Americans was exactly at 5%. The other year, it was 6%. Now, this evidence of racial balancing happened all after Fisher versus Texas. Race-neutral alternatives. When Ms. Fisher applied to the University of Texas in 2008, the white admissions rate was a majority. It was 51%. Since then, as we allege in the complaint, because of the top 10% plan, it has gone up. It has gone down, and it is now barely a third. So there is enormous racial diversity that has happened since Ms. Fisher filed her lawsuit. And so that goes to whether UT right now has available race-neutral alternatives. And finally, whether race is how UT uses race. So until 2017, UT publicly reported that race was a factor that they only considered. In 2017, UT publicly reported that race was a factor that is very important. That's according to UT's own documents. And again, if UT has changed its use of race, it is now increasing its use of race, that is another change in facts that, according to UT's public documents, didn't exist before 2008.
Let me go back on the other part of claim preclusion, which is the privity. I think you were not doing the district court's opinion full justice. Because he also, or did I just not hear it, the court also held that either Bloom or Fisher controlled the previous litigation, and then he seems to tie that to the current state of SFFA and says that they also control the present litigation.
He did say that, that's correct. And let me be clear about the facts here. Ms. Fisher controlled her own lawsuit. She decided whether to go forward. She selected her own attorneys. She was in total control of her lawsuit. Mr. Bloom assisted her in those efforts. It's not uncommon in civil litigation, civil rights litigation. He acted as her representative, speaking with her attorneys, and a nonprofit organization that he's part of helped to pay for her legal bills. So there's the distinction for Ms. Fisher. For SFFA is run by a 5-person board of directors. They are in control of SFFA. Mr. Bloom and Ms. Fisher are only 2 of a 5-person board of directors. And so there is absolutely nothing within those facts, these undisputed facts, that can somehow bring the privity element together under Taylor and this court's precedents in Meza and that sort of thing.
You know, I just don't get it. Let's say Mr. Blum and Ms. Fisher did exactly what you just said back in the Fisher case, which they're perfectly legally entitled to do. And they lost. Okay. So they're disappointed and they say, all right, we're going to form an organization to help other people sue. It's a membership organization. And we're going to control it, whatever that means. We're going to control this membership organization. And we're going to sue. And let's say what you just said is true, that the policies at UT have developed somewhat, and now there's maybe a different kind of challenge you could bring. And so they bring the lawsuit on behalf, the organization they've formed and they control brings this lawsuit. And, there's a challenge to it on standing grounds, and so we can adjudicate that over here. What's wrong? What's to prevent them from doing that? Why does that implicate res judicata? Why can't they do that?
It doesn't.
They're bringing lawsuit in 2 different capacities. Fisher was the plaintiff. And here, let's say in my hypothetical, she's running the organization. Well, she's no longer the plaintiff. She couldn't be the plaintiff. She wouldn't have standing, right? Somebody else might have standing, and the organization might be helping them. But none of this is illegal. So I just don't get it at all.
One might say this sort of characterizes Thurgood Marshall's career.
Exactly, Your Honor.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Right. And if cases from this court, Johnson and I believe Howell, discuss this about how people can act in different capacities. You can have your own personal capacity. You could be acting as a in a capacity representing a corporation or an organization. And like you said, there's nothing wrong with that. And there's nothing in this court's precedent or in Taylor or anywhere that somehow the facts you describe all of a sudden bring these cases in.
So I understand you can make factual distinctions about the control today by Fisher and Blum, and there's Fisher's father and there's 2 other people. And I get that. Those are valid points. Do you think those are determinative, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask in my...
No, not at all. I mean, this is a straightforward case. You go to Taylor, you look at these exceptions. The only one that they've even pointed to is the control exception. You ask, did SFFA control the Fisher lawsuit? The answer is no. SFFA didn't even come into existence until 2014, and that's the end of it. There's absolutely no privity here. The district court, just for my time runs out, going back to the same claim or cause of action, what the district court basically said was that it really only had 2 points. It looked at the similarity of the complaints, that they both recounted UT's history of using race in the admissions process, and it said that they're both challenging, both cases challenged the use or the use of race under the Equal Protection Clause.
What if you had discovery in this case? Let's say, hypothetically, you're able to go forward with this case, and you have discovery, and you discover during discovery, oh, my goodness, UT hasn't changed a single iota of its race-based admissions policy. What happens then? I mean, is it race judicata after you've had your discovery?
No.
What would happen if that, just by hypothesis, if that happened?
This case would still go forward, and you look, for example, Fisher 2 at the end, the court said very clearly, just because we're holding that the University of Texas, its use of race in 2008 is constitutional, that does not mean that UT can use race indefinitely.
Under my hypothetical, you might lose the case, and you might have wasted your time, but that doesn't mean it's race judicata.
That's right, Your Honor.
All right, so you have a chance for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Powers?
Good morning, and may it please the court. The district court got it right on race judicata and wrong on associational standing. SFFA, having elected to form itself as a non-membership corporation under the Virginia state law of its formation, cannot now lay claim to the status of a traditional membership organization for purposes of standing in this court.
So every court to consider this claim has ruled against that argument. So where did they go wrong?
Your Honor, in a couple of places. First, none of those courts have studied and analyzed and discussed the dispositive effect of the Articles of Incorporation and Virginia law. In the Articles of Incorporation, SFFA provided the following: the corporation shall have no members, close quote, end stop. SFFA would have this court read against that plain language and against its ordinary meaning, and instead read it to say, SFFA shall have no members except as provided in the bylaws. There are two problems with that argument. First, it's contrary to the plain language in the actual articles themselves. And second, it's contrary to Virginia law. Now, section 13.1.837 of the Virginia Code gives corporate entities that are formed as non-stock corporations two choices in formation, either to have members or to have no members. And if they elect to have members, they actually have to provide for that in the Articles of Incorporation and set the membership status in terms of both the voting rights as well as the qualifications. And what that provision says is that it can either be provided in the articles themselves or, if the articles say so, in the bylaws.
But that has, I mean, as best I understand that provision, that's basically for nonprofit companies, is that right?
It's for a non-stock corporation under Virginia law, which is what SFFA is.
I understand that, but I mean, I can't imagine a business entity organizing itself as a non-stock corporation unless that's, Judge King is the expert on this, but I assume it has more to do with anyway. But the point of members or no members has to do with the rights that those members would have in liquidation, does it not?
Well, Your Honor, it goes not just to liquidation, but it goes to various things. We cite to 13.1.845 of the Virginia Code, which specifies that members have an opportunity to inspect the membership roster. That's an opportunity that's withheld from the so-called members of SFFA because it doesn't qualify as a
member. I'm not talking about the members of SFFA, which were created by the bylaws. I'm just asking preliminarily about maybe a country club would be a non-stock corporation. I don't know. But the point is, the members of that kind of organization are people who might have some claim on its assets at some point, whereas another nonprofit is going to be run without the members. Like if I become a quote member of some organization by donating money, I don't have any claim on its assets, right? I mean, in other words, the statute has a limited scope.
Your Honor, as I understand the question, there are some entities like LLCs, for instance, where the members actually have a financial interest in the organization. This non-stock corporation statute doesn't address that specific point. Here, the most analogous kind of entity to SFFA is the Friends of the Earth in the Fifth Circuit case that we cite to this panel, and it also follows on the Public Interest Research Group of New Jersey case out of the Third Circuit. Both of those cases dealt with situations in which there was a statutory procedure available to create a membership entity that the plaintiff chose not to follow the specific requirements to be able to form a membership entity that would be, quote, a traditional membership organization.
But how do you know that that language is exclusive?
I'm sorry, which language, Your Honor?
The statutory language. How do you prove that language is exclusive and prevents an organization from having voluntary members like SFFA?
Your Honor, that's essentially what happened in Friends of the Earth v. Chevron. What you had was a District of Columbia statute, which provided for an opportunity to create a membership organization. And in that case, the Friends of the Earth went through the process of actually having bylaws that would allow for members. They got to that step of the analysis. We say SFFA fails a step earlier because their articles forbid members. But Friends of the Earth got one step further. Their bylaw said you can have members, the board just needs to set the requirements. Well, the board fell asleep at the switch. They never set the requirements. And what Judge Schell said at the district court level was, you lack associational standing entirely. The Fifth Circuit on review said you can get to the indicia of membership test and ended up holding that they satisfied that test. But at step one, it was not a traditional membership organization. It could not be a traditional membership organization because the failure to meet state law requirements prohibited that result.
Well, that's well and good, but we're dealing with Virginia law, and I ask you, how do you prove that the Virginia provision is exclusive of the organizational status of SFFA?
Yes, Your Honor, and it's just the plain language of 13.1.837, which provides just for this one way to give rise to members. It says it's either you have members, in which case it's got to be provided for in the articles, or you have no members.
All right, we've been over that.
But yes, Your Honor.
As I understand their argument, this statutory issue was raised before the other courts.
Your Honor, not quite. There was no citation.
You don't think they had an equal motivation with University of Texas to question it?
Well, Your Honor, I'm sure they were equally motivated. There are a couple of differences. One is that those cases did not arise out of the Fifth Circuit. They also didn't arise out of the Third Circuit case, which had a dispositive binding holding with a very similar fact pattern, that Perg of New Jersey case. And furthermore, there was no citation to Leon v. Martin, a case decided by a Virginia Circuit Court that said that when there is a conflict between the Articles of Incorporation, says no members, and bylaws that seem to provide for members, it's the articles that control. Now, those cases never discussed that the articles render the bylaws providing for members not merely voidable, but actually void. And so the fact that there is discussion in Judge Pittman's opinion, as well as the two other district court opinions in UNC and Harvard of the bylaws, does not change the analysis for this court, because this court has the benefit of Leon v. Martin, has the benefit of the Virginia Code 819 provision that says that provision renders those articles void. Now, I want to turn next to the discussion of the various indicia of membership. If this court agrees that the SFFA fails that test of a traditional membership organization, that's not the end of the road. The next step of the analysis is to ask whether or not the indicia of membership are nonetheless present. And this court in Friends of the Earth identified the traditional factors which the U.S. Supreme Court originally identified in Hunt, whether there was election of leadership, service in the organization's leadership, and financing of the organization's activities. Your Honor, this SFFA cannot possibly satisfy those factors under the facts of this case. Election of leadership. It's undisputed that at most there is one director that is elected by the so-called members of the organization. Three of the members were original founders and are also serve as the only officers of the organization: Mr. Bloom, Ms. Fisher, and her father, Mr. Richard Fisher. As far as service and leadership, the record is undisputed that the only opportunity that the so-called members have to do anything with respect to service in the organization, it doesn't involve service in committees, it doesn't involve service in working groups, they can report whatever comments they may have directly to Mr. Bloom. He received those and does whatever he will with them. He is the sole person with any day-to-day operational responsibility for this organization. That's admitted and undisputed. With respect to financing, it's undisputed in this case that in 2019, dues comprised only 0.17% of the entire financing of this organization. And through November of 2017, over 96% of the funding for this organization came from institutional donors.
Do people pay dues to be in the NAACP?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, aren't there other organizations that do a lot of litigating where members contribute nominal amounts and there are a few benefactors who support a great deal of the organization's mission?
Your Honor, I believe that is a common arrangement that comes up in many of these situations. In some ways, this case is a very unique one that doesn't come up very often. Most associational standing plaintiffs have not made the choice that SFFA has here to make themselves a non-membership organization by the choice of invoke a statute that precludes them from being a membership organization and to build that into their original articles of incorporation.
Judge Pittman, by the way, stepping back a second, I'm sorry to do this, but Judge Pittman said that the First Circuit did rule based on the Virginia statute.
Your Honor.
So you're asking us to create a circuit split.
Your Honor, I don't believe Judge Pittman that concluded that they considered the effect of the particular Virginia Code provision that says when there's a conflict between the bylaws and the Articles of Incorporation that the articles trump. And that's a distinction that matters because that's not an unfamiliar principle that the articles will trump. It's just like the Constitution trumps a statute if there's a inconsistency there.
Well, that's slicing it pretty fine about a circuit split. But so Judge Pittman slightly misstated that, and your brief barely attempts to defend his rulings on claim preclusion. So where did he get it right?
Well, let me turn to the claim preclusion because he did get it right on that point, Your Honor. For claim preclusion to apply, it's conceded that two of the four factors are implicated here, and there's only two that need inquiry. One is whether we have privity. SFFA misinterprets Taylor v. Sturgill when they say that those six factors are the sole exclusive list of factors. In fact, in footnote 9, the Supreme Court said, we're not stating a definitive taxonomy with this listing.
Let's assume that's true. What factor are you relying on to show privity, non-party preclusion?
Yes, Your Honor. As to privity, it's both common control and proxy litigation. And what a good example of this was the Ferris v. Cuevas Second Circuit opinion we cited, in which the court held that when you've got a common set of actors litigating from the shadows through different parties, that's a situation where the court should apply the privity factor.
So here's why I'm skeptical.
Yes, Your Honor.
I want to be perfectly frank. Let's say you have a different lawsuit. You have two black plaintiffs who are challenging a racist admissions policy at, let's say, the University of Alabama. Okay, call the plaintiffs Plessy and Sweat. You know, they're challenging it because they say you're discriminating against black applicants and it violates the Equal Protection Clause. So Plessy and Sweat lose. Goes all the way to Supreme Court, they lose. So they say, okay, now we can't challenge it anymore. We no longer have standing. They wait a few years. They form an organization. Call it the NAACP. Okay, and they say, now we've formed this organization. We control it. And the reason we formed this organization, we want to help other people challenge University of Alabama's policy. Now, why can't they do that? Why does claim preclusion have anything to do with their ability to form the NAACP and challenge the University of Alabama's policy? And let's further stipulate the University of Alabama made a few changes to their racist policy, and so now it's a slightly different racist policy.
Your Honor, I'd submit that in that situation, you're likely to have a genuine traditional membership organization that's actually formed with the members controlling, steering the organization's efforts.
I asked about different claim preclusion. I didn't ask about standing.
Sure, but in this instance, what we're talking about is a fact pattern that suggests that Mr. Bloom, Mr. Fisher, and Ms. Fisher, those three people control the entity. They are the ones that are directing everything and calling the shots, not these student members who are coming in.
Well, excuse me, don't they have a right to support the litigation of the two plaintiffs whom you do not disagree have standing?
They have an opportunity to assist however they want, but if they want to actually control a new entity and call the shots for that new entity, they are bound by the doctrine of claim preclusion as well as issue preclusion. Your Honor, I see my time has expired.
You have time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Mr. Hinojosa?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. David Hinojosa for the Black Student Alliance, Texas NAACP, Texas Orange Jackets, and individual students. I'll be addressing the standing of the individual two members that were recruited online by SFFA. The District Court committed two fundamental errors in its analysis that undermine Article 3's mandate to ensure that only cases, real cases and controversies are before the Court. First, the Court failed to undertake any analysis of whether plaintiff's two members have standing for each of its four claims and relief requested in this case as required by Town of Chester. Instead, and quite remarkably, the court held that because Fisher had standing and defendants argue that this litigation is controlled by Mr. Bloom and the Fishers, then SFFA's associational members must have standing. But Article 3 cannot be satisfied by osmosis. And this court and the Supreme Court have made it clear that the courts must not dispense with standing in gross. But that's exactly what the court did here. The second error occurred when the court applied a reduced standing burden, concluding that plaintiff need only allege three facts to demonstrate standing. Its members are white, they were denied admission, and they're willing to transfer. To be clear, interveners recognize that Northeastern Florida contractors created an exception to the Lujan requirements in cases where there is an explicit government-imposed burden that places applicants on unequal footing because of their race.
Isn't that their claim here?
No, Your Honor.
The
key distinction, because, again, we're not debating on whether or not there's different standing in cases challenging set-aside programs or mechanical preferences. But none of those exist here. UT's policy is a facially neutral, holistic admissions policy, and both the Supreme Court and this court have judicially determined that the consideration of race may benefit Black, Latinx, Asian American, and white students alike. So there is no... Latinx, Hispanic, Your Honor?
Hispanic.
But this court recognized as much when following the Fisher.
That's your argument. That's your defense. They have a different claim. They claim, no, this violates equal protection clause because it uses race in a way that's forbidden by the Constitution.
But what matters is whether the policy itself is facially neutral.
Who are you saying has no standing? Individual plaintiffs or the organization?
Well, the organization is claiming standing through its membership.
I understand
under the
that, and we've been going through that with Mr. Powers. So are you just reinforcing what Mr. Powers said? I thought you were also challenging the individuals.
No, we are talking about the individuals.
Okay.
The individual standing
Did
members.
Did you offer any evidence at trial? I realize standing has to persist throughout the litigation, and ultimately the plaintiffs have the burden, but did you make an evidentiary challenge of any sort?
It was both a facial and a factual challenge, Your Honor. And here's how their complaint fails facially. It lacks any clear, sufficient facts demonstrating how any of its members, two standing members' injuries, were traceable to the UT's actions complained of, or how a court's remedy would likely redress their injury. That's required by Spokio versus Robbins. And
well,
in fact...
Go ahead.
Sorry, Your Honor. In fact, When you look at their allegations and their complaint, it actually goes against their own standing arguments. Count one, for example, claims that UT uses race as a predominant factor. Count three claims that UT racially balances black students by admitting between 3% and 5%.
So what are you saying? They might or might not have been admitted because this is such a clever policy that we can disguise the fact that we have consistently reduced, that the number of white students has consistently gone down?
That goes to the merits, Your Honor. We don't need to get to that.
Can allege whatever they want.
And they have not. What they have alleged, if you look at paragraph 110, they concede that students of color admitted through the Race Conscious Admissions Plan would have been admitted anyway without the consideration of race. So they're claiming that UT is using race as a predominant factor, yet they readily admit that race isn't really playing much of a factor at all. So if you enjoin that practice, how does it benefit the plaintiffs?
Were you involved in the voter ID litigation in Texas?
The voter ID?
Yes. VZ.
No, Your Honor, I wasn't directly involved.
Let me pose you a hypothetical, because there were two or three individual plaintiffs who were the representative plaintiffs, and MALDEF was suing on their behalf and so on. And when it finally came to trial, it turned out that the theory was that the voter ID law prejudiced the ability of minorities to vote. And when it finally came to trial on the case, it turned out that at least two out of the three prospective Hispanic plaintiffs had not been, and this is partly hypothetical, partly going on memory, had not been deterred from voting. Should the court have dismissed that case for lack of standing at that point, at least as to those individuals?
Well, that might end up going more to the merits of it as opposed to whether or not they suffered an injury
in
fact that it was traceable.
This is a 12B6, isn't it?
No, this is a 12B1, Your Honor.
All right, it's a 12B1. But I'm not sure where the court got the facts, except they were undisputed, right?
Well, and what the court?
The facts were undisputed, were they not?
The facts in this case?
Yeah.
The facts in this case are disputed to the extent that SFFA claims its two members could have been harmed, for example, by the race-neutral admissions plan, yet their own deposition testimony, because we did take deposition, they would not allow us to seek much information.
Well, they weren't allowed to get into the merits either.
Well, yes, and we certainly weren't trying to get the merits, but we were trying to find a paper trail.
So what did you ascertain that precludes their standing?
Well, one, what we did, again, I think facially, if you look at the complaint, there's not any clear facts that demonstrate how any of its potential
claims. Okay, so you're not relying on the evidence. You're only relying on the statements in the complaint.
So the complaint itself.
Is that true or not? I mean, your whole argument has been on the complaint, which is why I was mistaken about, forgotten about the evidence.
Sure, Your Honor. So in the deposition, we were inquiring as to the race-neutral alternatives and their own standing of these individuals. Throughout the complaint, which reads more like a personal grievance and a policy brief as opposed to a real complaint, they allege that the race-neutral alternatives, such as lifting the 75% cap, just like what Fisher said, Fisher actually would have possibly gotten in if they had lifted the cap because she was in the top 11% at that time. What we found out was that they would not benefit from lifting the cap because they weren't even in the top 10% right now because so many admissions are, so many students
controlled
are admitted
by race
through.
Rather than the top 10%. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, there's a 75% cap, but because so many students apply to UT, you're only talking about the top
6%. Well, how come I don't see a single reference to any fact like that in Judge Pittman's opinion?
Well, because he applied
standing. Did you argue it? Did you argue it? Did you brief it to him?
Absolutely. And the reason why is because he erred by failing to independently examine whether the standing members have standing in this case and instead assumed
that they had standing based on Fisher and Grutter in their facts in their own
case.
All
right, thank you very much. Now I understand your argument, and we'll look closely at the record to see whether it supports it.
All right, thank you, Judge.
Thank you, sir. Okay, Mr. Connolly.
I only have two quick points to make. First, on claim preclusion, they again don't argue that any Taylor exception applies. They say that Taylor should be read to not limit it to six exceptions. That not only does that conflict with Taylor, this court's precedent, but it also conflicts with the Third, the Fourth, and the 11th circuits. So accepting that would create a circuit split on this claim, this privity issue. On standing, every single court that has looked at SFFA standing has held that SFFA has standing. The District of Massachusetts, the Middle District of North Carolina, and the First Circuit. The idea that Harvard's counsel, the University of North Carolina's counsel, missed this argument is just wrong.
Well, don't you also, have to show that two plaintiffs had individual standing, right?
Sure. And we show that here. It's for the same reasons in Harvard and North Carolina. We've identified individuals who are denied from, who are members of SFFA, who are denied admission to UT, and they have stated their intent to transfer or to apply to transfer once UT stops discriminating.
Was this issue decided on allegations or on evidence?
Evidence. There was deposition testimony and declarations from our two standing members.
But he's saying that your members sort of pleaded themselves out of court or gave testimony that rendered them out of court or something like that.
Respectfully, I really don't understand the intervener's argument. UT doesn't make it. Harvard never made it. UNC never made it. It's foreclosed by Supreme Court precedent. And finally, on the UT's argument, no court, including this court, has ever held that an association needs to look to state law to prove whether it has statutory members. Cases from this court, like the Association of American Physicians, Speech First, there's a whole long line of cases from the Fifth Circuit where nobody ever does this inquiry. And the First Circuit and the District of Massachusetts made a similar comment as well. And so for all those reasons, this court should reverse, and this case should be remanded so it can be heard on the merits.
For practical purposes, though, I mean, I'm not trying to get you to commit to anything, but there are obviously two Supreme Court cases, Harvard, UNC, that are going to be decided. What's going to happen in this case if it gets remanded, in your view?
Yeah, there's a chance that this case, once it's remanded, could be stayed pending Harvard. And
that's what happened with the Yale case, right?
Correct, and that's what happened with when Harvard and UNC were in the litigation phase. That's what happened during Fisher II. So I would not be surprised if, once this is remanded, before you go to the merits, the case is stayed pending the Supreme Court's decisions.
All right, thank you. Final case.